Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. This is another episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jake McClure. Usually Jeff McClure joins me, but he is still out and recovering. We expect to hear him back on the radio in probably a month. So that's good news to hear on that front. And I hear some other stuff coming in through my headset. Just a moment. Lots of extra noise. All right, got that fixed. All right, so let's start with what we are. Who is this guy talking to you on the air at the moment? I am Jake McClure, and I'm one of the principals at the investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, called the Personal Wealth Coach, which also is the name of the program that you're listening to. The firm in Salado is registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission to give fiduciary investment advice. They are the regulators that you should complain to if you hear me say something damaging. Not if you hear me say something silly or stupid, because then you would be spending all your time complaining. That's all I say. All right. So generally we start the program. Let me give you the phone number to call in here. It's 254-773-1400 if you want to join in the discussion. Generally, we start the program with what's happened in the market in the week since you last heard my voice. And if you didn't hear my voice last week, shame on you. Or maybe it's better for your sanity. So, in the past week, from Monday to Friday, the S&P 500, which is an index that we watch, we don't invest directly into it as an index vehicle, but we watch it. It's up 1.9% for the week. This has come amidst a time when there haven't been much in the way of headlines about the good market performance. It's fascinating to me that the headlines can say, talk about a relatively minor, half that as far as the rise goes. This is almost a 2% rise, but half of that makes big headlines if it's a drop. So the media is designed, you pay them and I pay them, to tell us the bad news of the world. Every once in a while they slip in some good news, but that's not really what we pay them for. So you're going to have to hear some good news from me. The market is doing well this year. Since mid-February, which was kind of the bottom of the market in our last correction, the market is up, the S&P 500 is up 18.35%. Yes, you heard that right. Almost 20%. I mention the returns in the market occasionally, and people say that still happens. They're shocked that it still happens like that, because in the banks we're experiencing a much lower interest rate. Yes, but the return of the market has to do with the risk that you're taking in the market. That's a big, big chunk of where that return comes from. The risk is the downside of that upside, because back in February we were down somewhere around 11% from the high in the market from before that. So being up 18%, we're back into the area right up next to record territory. All right, 18%, good job, except the records that we're breaking when we break records these days are the records that we last touched or were broken in 2006 and 2007. So it's been a decade. It's about time for us to be breaking records again. But when people say the market's getting high, we're breaking records, just remember that it's taken us a decade to get back up here. There have been a lot of changes made internally in the structure of all those companies that we're watching in the market. And hopefully they've been for the better. But sometimes, this is what's happened in the last couple of weeks with Wells Fargo, we see that sometimes the changes for the better only happened in the companies that were really bad to begin with. And Wells Fargo was very proud of being great through the recession. They didn't have any of those horrible things that the rest of the big banks were doing with the mortgages and so on. And now they've got this scandal. That's called hubris. And I'm going to explain how we in Texas, if you're in Texas, I realize a lot of you are listening from other locations these days, but in Texas, we have the same kind of hubris. I love Texas. Texas is as far as I'm concerned, on business matters, the leader of the country. I mean, we could do more. Obviously, we can always do more. But right now, we are the leader in the country when it comes to business. And part of that is because we had a sock to the chin, a massive uppercut that the rest of the country didn't share. When the dot-com bubble burst, the tech locations got hit hardest. And Texas was one of the major tech locations at that point. So we got knocked down. We got pummeled into the dirt. It caused our real estate prices to drop. It caused our unemployment rates to rise. It caused us to look worse than the rest of the country. Then over time, as we worked to fix that, as we said, let's not do that again, we started shoring things up. We started having a rainy day fund used regularly, added to regularly by the state. We had a big fund set up to help bring businesses to Texas. We looked at business infrastructure and we said, how can we make it easier to form businesses here? And then the Great Recession hit. And the rest of the country who'd missed the dot-com crash, I mean, they'd experienced it, but they didn't experience it anywhere near the depth that we experienced it here in Texas. They weren't prepared for it, and we were. So they got pummeled. The rest of the country's real estate prices dropped drastically. We had a small drop here. Before the Great Recession, a little place in central Texas called Killeen had the lowest market prices on real estate in the country. So we didn't have a long ways to go down. Since then, we are picking up that same hubris that Wells Fargo had. We have to be careful about that. Just because we missed the last one, we got to stretch our memories a little bit. We missed the last one because the one before that hit us so hard. We're not immune. We're not bulletproof. If we're not careful, we can destroy the things that we use to create the safety to allow us to not be hit so hard in the Great Recession. So keep that in mind. Wells Fargo's in that same boat. They did great during the Great Recession. Good job, Wells Fargo. You weren't scamming the world. You weren't giving loans to people you knew couldn't pay them. You weren't selling those loans off to other people. You've only waited a while and then started making up fake accounts for people and started charging them for those fake accounts. No, they didn't do it institutionally. It didn't start at the top and go down. It started at the low level because when you give money to people for doing things, they will find new ways of doing those things that you give them money for. It's called incentive. If you have a really good incentive to do things and you don't feel like it's hurting anyone and everyone's doing it, why not? That sounds really familiar with the mortgage crisis from 2007 and 8 through 2009, is that these mortgage brokers were just saying everybody's doing this, so it can't be that wrong. Well, that's what was going on at a very deep level in Wells Fargo. At the low level, people were being compensated by adding more products to the clientele, the customer's portfolio. You get an extra credit card, you get an extra bank account. And in the process of adding those in, and this is something that's, you know, even I, and I say that, it almost sounds arrogant, when I'm looking at my bank account information, I log in and I'm looking at it. If another account showed up there and it didn't have any charges against it and it was empty, I would probably, and this is a probably, I would probably call my bank and say what happened. But if I was particularly busy, I'd look at it and say, well, maybe my wife set that up. Maybe I set it up and it's just now showing up and I can't remember what I did. This isn't like a fraudulent charge on a credit card. It's just there's another bank account there. Well, maybe they're just giving bank accounts away this week. So Wells Fargo was doing something that the majority of the people that were doing it didn't think would hurt the customer, but it still hurt the customer. And the government has come in and slapped them for it. So keep that in mind when we're thinking about the way we run our government in Texas. Let's not get that same kind of hubris to say that recessions don't hurt us because we're Texas. Recessions don't hurt us because we get ready for them before they happen. And if we keep that mentality and we keep a good rainy day fund at the legislature and we keep our regulatory process and new businesses to a point that keeps fraud out but doesn't prevent new businesses from starting, then we're going to be in good shape. Okay, I have a lot to talk about this week, but you are absolutely welcome, not only absolutely welcome, but you're asked to call in and help me out with this, because otherwise it's just going to be my voice droning on indefinitely, and to me that sounds a little bit like nails on a chalkboard. So if you would like to join, the number in here is 254-773-1400. Last week, I talked quite a lot about the way I analyze a socioeconomic system. Generally speaking, that can be a country, but I could use it for states or for municipalities. I could use it for companies. I can use it for large and small institutions. And I spent a lot of time talking about the strengths and weaknesses of the United States. We've got some really big strengths. Our country, our socioeconomic system, our culture is leading the world. And when I say leading the world, it's by far. There's nobody that's even close to coming to touch the kind of influence that we have on the world based on our business. On the governmental level, there's a lot of politics. That's what governments do. But even so, our government has a greater impact on the rest of the world than most of the rest of the world combined. So keeping that in mind, saying America is in great shape, we also have some weaknesses, and those weaknesses are relatively large. They're just not that big a deal when you compare them to all the problems in the rest of the world. So some of the things that I talked about the good things that we have. Upper education, it's the strongest in the world. I'm refreshing this for those of you who listened last week and filling in the rest of you who didn't with what I talked about, because I had several questions, a series of questions, and I'm going to answer a few of them that came to me during the week from listeners who said, hey, can you talk about these areas? I talked about the strengths, so I'm going to hit them really quick. We have the strongest education, upper education system in the world, by far. Our entrepreneurship is the strongest in the world. Our communication infrastructure is at least competitive with the best in the world. As far as innovation and property rights go, we lead the world. When it comes to our capital markets, we're up there with London, with Great Britain. We have the ability to trade what we produce in a better way than almost anywhere else in the world. When it comes to the skills associated with the businesses, we have a better and greater pool of people waiting to do the things that we want them to do here in the United States than anywhere else in the world. We have a higher education system that produces people that are ready to innovate. We have industrial clusters that are absolutely megalithic. If you look at who's dominating the internet right now, the top 100 companies on the internet, 90 of them are from the United States. That says something, because the internet is the trading mechanism of the world at the moment. We're switching away from the brick and mortar. We're moving into the internet. This is something people have been predicting for decades. Well, it's looking like we're hitting that crossover point where the majority of trade is going to be taking place on the internet. And the United States dominates that. So I had some questions last week about the passing over of control of the internet to some foreign government. Well, first off, and I answered this to some extent, and this has reached the political level, which means that the level of understanding goes down as soon as a major political figure starts talking about it, because sound bites don't give you information, and it doesn't matter which side of the political arena you are listening to. As soon as a politician starts trying to explain a problem, they're going to make it into a bigger problem so that they can solve it. Even if it's not a problem, it becomes a problem so that they can solve it. So the news media has been supporting this concept a bit too. So let's talk about trade on the internet, who controls the internet, what it is, all that good stuff. There is a nonprofit organization called ICANN, and it's been the same nonprofit organization under contract in certain areas with the government, but mostly not working at all for the government, that's been controlling our major domain name system, our domain name servers. We've got 13 big ones in the United States that all the other websites out there, if you type in google.com, your computer goes to check the domain name server. What does that mean? What IP address should I go to? It's like a Dewey Decimal system for the library. And it's sitting out there, and your computer goes to it, and it's, from our perspective, completely seamless. There's no time taken to do it because it does it so fast. So it goes to the place that we associate with Google. The company that regulates that Dewey Decimal system to say who goes where has been licensed by the United States government for decades to do this. The same organization, which is an American company, is going to continue to do it. It will no longer be licensed by the government. The government's going to step back and say, we don't really have any business licensing the internet because the internet's bigger than we are. So the fear about America giving up control of the internet, one, the government didn't take any control when it was holding it. It didn't say, out of the blue, Google gets this IP address. They licensed that out to ICANN, this company. It's a not-for-profit organization. Same company is going to be dealing with it now. The alternative is that the United States still has influence on what happens in the internet, a big influence that they could take at some point. And if they were China or they were Russia, they would take. They would say, you're only allowed to see what the government sees. So it's the conservatives who are talking about America losing control of the internet. Now, let me hit the pause button there. America's not lost control of the internet. And America, for almost any intent, owns the internet. When I just said the top 100 companies in the internet, 90 of them are American. That's not something that goes away because licenses for how domain names are registered changes. We still have most of the traffic. We still have most of the trade on the internet. Now, China has a lot as well, but they've not been using our system at all. They've never used ICANN for their domain name system. Some of their companies, when they register overseas, not when they're in China, use our system. We haven't lost anything there. What we're gaining is more freedom on the internet because there's no governmental control over what's on there. I don't like big government. And in the past, the conservatives said the same thing, but it's the conservatives that are upset about America losing control. It's not America losing control. It's the government saying the free market should govern the internet. I'm really surprised that the conservatives are upset because we're going to a free market system. But the conservatives are upset about a lot of free market enterprise right now. They want the government to control trade, and they want the government to control the internet. I'm not saying the Democrats are doing a better job, and far from it. They're both completely walking in circles trying to figure out even what's going on. The talking points are not the appropriate talking points for the actual problems that we face. And that's the next set of questions. I had some questions. I mentioned last week that while our upper education system is absolutely, by such a big, big margin, the best in the world, and by a big margin, I mean you take the rest of the world and you combine them, all of them, everybody, and you put their education system at the collegiate level, at the upper education level, and compare it against America, and we beat them so thoroughly that there's not even, I mean, it's not even a competition. It's like the first dream team in the basketball Olympics. there wasn't and isn't any kind of competition. When you look at the top 100 colleges, the vast majority of them, and we're back up there in the 90 plus again, are American. The rest of them are British. That's the education system that the rest of the world admires. However, we have a tremendous weakness right in the middle of this. I'm talking about this great education in the upper area. K through 12, our kindergarten through high school, is not good and getting worse. This is, please don't hear me saying anything bad about the teachers or even about the administration, because they've been handed rules and guidelines that they must follow. It's a frustrating thing from their perspective. They've got to follow a set of rules that they don't believe is the most beneficial to all of their kids. Our K through 12 level is really suffering. When we compare that to the rest of the world, we're showing up just above the third world nations. And in some cases, the third world nations are beating us. We're creating an artificial brain drain on our population. It's not the only time this has happened in history. Not for America. It's the only time it's happened so far in American history. But Rome had this happen. When they became the dominating factor of the world, when they became the place that everyone needed to come to do business, they stopped using the native-born citizens of Rome to innovate. They imported their innovation, and we're doing it now in our upper education system. I mean, how does this square up? We've got a bad K through 12 and the best upper education system in the world. That doesn't seem to square up, because if that's the case, then how would our kids be going to college? And they are a lot, and we're getting more people going to college than ever before in the United States. Upper education beyond the undergraduate level. That is where we're falling down. The best schools in the country at the graduate level have half of their students coming in on the H-1B visa. That means that's what's considered the genius visa, where everybody else in the rest of the world really wants to go to Harvard or Yale or Wharton or University of Chicago or Berkeley, or you can just keep right on going down the list. If everybody wants to come here, we've got this big demand. And our students are not able to compete the way we have historically. Half of the students across the board in the graduate level programs of upper education in the United States tend to be from other countries. That's not me being xenophobic. I think it's amazing if we can bring them here and make them citizens and get the brain drain from the rest of the world and replace what we're doing inappropriately with our K through 12. That's an amazing thing. But we're also losing some of them back to their parent countries. The reason why there's a new Silicon Valley type institution in China is because we educated them here and they went back. So we're dealing with a competition, just like Rome did, of people that we've educated in the best systems in the world here and then sent them back to compete with us. That's not brilliant. So what's wrong with our K through 12 system? That was one of the questions. So I'm going to go through one of the first things someone should ask, anyone should ask, and this is straight out of 7 Habits for Highly Effective People. It's through any kind of management course. It's ubiquitous in proper management. You begin with the end in mind. It doesn't matter if we're planning a vacation or planning what product we're going to create to sell to the public. If you don't know where you're going on vacation, likely is that you're going to get where you don't know where you're going, whatever that might be. So what is the end in mind that we have for our K through 12 education? Hopefully, the end in mind is a fully employable student who's no longer a student, someone that can go into business and has the education to seamlessly move into it. There are going to be skills that they haven't learned in school always, but they have the ability to pick up those skills quickly on the job because they have a good foundation. That's where we're falling down. We are treating K through 12 as if everyone is going to college. And that's a problem, because not everyone is going through college, going to go to college. I took some statistics off the internet. Whether or not they're right, they're from the internet and they are at least semi-vetted. I didn't go into as much depth as I should have gone into, I think, in really getting this down. So these numbers kind of add up. They seem to be fairly accurate, but take them with a little bit of a grain of salt. And if you are an administrator at one of these school districts, let me know. Because of the location of the studio in Temple, I looked around and I said, let's look at some of the local school districts and see the cost that they're paid per student in taxes and grants and other forms of money inflows. Let's see the results they're getting as far as, this is an important one, graduation rate, I would think, would be a pretty important factor in anybody's grading of the school system. This studio's in Temple. The data that I got from Zillow, which is a pretty well-respected site when it comes to schools, says that we have a graduation rate from the Temple School District of 72%. That's barely a passing grade on a test. 72%. And that's on a system that's designed to catch the people who are failing, the No Child Left Behind, which there are some problems with that. So let's go back. We can I think, and I've had this conversation with teachers, I've had this conversation with administrators. I've never met anyone in this area for the last decade that has not started the conversation by talking about all the problems. So please, again, don't hear me say that the teachers are doing something wrong or that the administration is even doing something wrong. We've got mandates from the federal and state level that must be met. Sometimes they're conflicting. That's part of the problem. Okay. From a business perspective, I'm a business owner. A lot of the people that listen to this program are also business owners. If they're not business owners, they're either in some form a practicing executive. If you think of all the doctors at Scott & White, Baylor Scott & White, if you think about people who have people working for them in any institution, if you are training people to do something that you've known how to do for a while, you know the system's broken. Because there are some really smart kids coming out of these schools that are completely unprepared for work. When they show up, they haven't got a clue which end of what thing to grab first. And that's scary, because this is what we're supposed to be doing. So let me take some steps back and say, where, when, and how was our education system K through 12 developed? Because it used to be the leader in the world. It was developed back in the early 19-teens and 1920s with help from people like Henry Ford, where they said there's this new concept of producing items, whether it be the Model T or any other thing. We've got an industrial line. You have the person in charge of a part be standing next to the line, and they work on that part all day long. They're putting that part on the vehicle. It goes forward and the next person puts their part on the vehicle. And it's a far more efficient process than one person putting the vehicle together all alone. Or even 12 people all trying to figure out which part goes on next. So this system was amazing. And if we looked at the education system of the time, you had probably K through 6 as being the top. Every once in a while you'd had some higher education, but it was expensive. There wasn't a public system to cover it, except those that had sprung up kind of haphazardly locally. The idea was you take kids above about the age of elementary school and you put them in that same industrial system, and it will help them learn to be good employees of a company when they get out. Because that's why Henry Ford wanted to help, because he wanted better employees. He didn't want better executives. They got to go to college for that. But he wanted better employees. So he said, my end result, my begin with the end in mind, is an employee that comes out of this system and can go and stand on my line, and I can give them a piece of paper that they can read, that they can understand the orders that I'm giving, and that they can do it efficiently. So our system was set up where a child comes in, past about middle school, in some places it's called junior high. They go to school, they go to their locker, they get the book that they need, the cog, the wheel, the part. They go to the appropriate class. The person in charge of that class is the teacher. They teach math or science or English all day long. And the student is the part that they're in charge of for that moment. So the student comes in, sits down, they learn math. They stand up at the end of the class, they go back to the locker, they get another book, they go to the next class, and so on. The idea here is that somebody's supposed to be in charge of the quality of the education for that child. But it's really hard to figure out who. So you've got homeroom teachers, or you have counselors, but the homeroom teacher is in charge of 30 or 40 people, sometimes more, and has to track them and doesn't have a whole lot of time to talk to the kid about what they need and if their needs are being met. Doesn't have time to do that because the homeroom is also a class and they have to teach that class. So that system was the best in the world, absolutely by far the best in the world. The rest of the world followed our lead on that because we were the leaders in industry. And then we became the leaders in education. And we haven't changed the system since. We've reinforced that industrial mentality, only we've done it with greater and greater bureaucracy, with greater and greater standardization on tests. Something I can tell you without any doubt in my mind is that each child is different. They have different interests, different strengths, different weaknesses. We're ignoring that, except when it comes to electives. Oh yeah, you can take speech, and you over there, you take track and field. And they get that choice. The rest of it is you get to learn geometry and calculus even though you're never going to use it. And you over there, algebra, you need it. You're never going to use it. Some people are going to use that every day. If you're a programmer, if you're an economist, to some extent, if you're doing research on almost anything, you use those skills. If you're an accountant, you don't use algebra. And that's a really great field. If you're an electrician, you don't use algebra. If you're in business, you don't tend to use algebra. So how is it that we have come to a point where everyone needs to learn something that not very many people are going to use? Now, I don't want to create ignorance in the world. I don't want to say nobody needs to learn that anymore. But we need to start customizing our education in the way that we customize the things that we buy today, not the things that we bought from Ford in 1920. But when you order a computer, you have the ability to get exactly the computer you want. When it comes to going to upper education, you have the ability to get exactly the education you want. When it comes to K through 12, you get what everybody gets, and you better like it. You got to take the standardized test, and if you don't do well in the standardized test, even if you do tremendously well in one area, if you fail in another, you're staying back. And we don't want people to be graduating who aren't able to understand some basics. And we've decided, and all of these choices were out of good intentions, extremely good intentions. And I'm going to keep talking about this when we come back because I think it's a vital piece to our economy that's being undercared for. It's being overlooked, and it doesn't need to be. We can do better than this. So I'm going to do some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the conversation, add things to it, argue with me about it, the number in here is 254-773-1400. And And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and if you'd like to join me on the air, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. I was talking about some improvements that could be done to the school system, and I'm saying this, it's sort of a pipe dream, because the bureaucracy and red tape to get anything changed here is dramatic. It's at the state level. It's at the national level. In order to get our system changed, in some ways we have to form a new system, completely scrap it and start over. And that's terrifying, because what if what we start over again with, well, what if it doesn't work? That's a big question. The problem that we have right now in our K through 12 is that we're not putting out kids who are capable of going into the workplace immediately on graduation, unless you're talking about completely unskilled jobs. So if they're becoming an electrician, an accountant, you could basically go down a list of any job that isn't completely unskilled, and they're leaving the education system with some literacy and with some math skills and sometimes with some computer skills, although those are generally antiquated because that's what's available in the school system. But we're paying enough per kid through this system to do it right. I was looking at the different school systems in here. I looked at Salado in Central Texas, Belton in Central Texas, Temple in Central Texas, and Killeen in Central Texas. And the range of money per student that these school districts get is the low end is Salado, who they get $6,769 per student per year, all the way up to Killeen, which is $7,683 per student per year. That's a big difference in the two. So you would think throw more money at it, you get a better school system. We know that that's not the way it works. It has to do with the culture in place in the school district. It has to do with the culture of the kids and what their family life is like and a lot of other things. So throwing money at it is something we've worked on for a long time. Here, just throw more money at it. That'll work. And then when the bad times come, well, then we have to cut the budget. Well, when you cut the budget, all the possible gain that you got from throwing money at it was not only lost, but it's worse than what it started with. And that's something that in any institution, if you raise the budget and then lower it back to where it was, you lose more than you gained, by far. It's just something that happens. You have to figure out how to do it appropriately, and that's really, really hard. At the school district level, there are a lot of regulations that have to be followed from the state and from the national. So let me say, rather than talking about the red tape, because there's a lot of it, let's say some things that are working in charter schools, that are working in other areas. Again, if we're beginning with the end in mind, if we say, what's the product we want out of here? We want a kid who's able to initiate business with a little bit of training. The things that happen in business. Number one, you don't tell customers an answer until you know it's right. In the school district, we teach them again and again and again, don't ask questions in a test. Don't collaborate, that's cheating. And any answer is better than no answer. All of those major principles that underlie the complete concept of how we're regulating the teaching of kids these days are the opposite of what they need to know in business. Collaborating with your fellow business people is how you achieve success. To a certain extent, you don't want to create a monopoly and fix prices, but to get things better done quicker, you collaborate with the people around you. And that's a minor portion of what we train in our K through 12. It's a portion that when we train it in the minor way, we then, when it comes to the end of the class, you're not allowed to do that anymore. It's test time. Stop collaborating. And don't leave a question blank, because that's automatically a wrong answer. Guess. If your accountant did that for you, you might not be so happy. If your electrician did that for you, you might not be so happy. If that's the world that we live in, You don't give an answer unless you know it's right. And where else do we do that except testing? So the testing system has been pulling against what we need coming out of the school system. Lack of collaboration. If we had better group systems for training kids, and there are systems that are using it. There's charter schools that are doing this. There's Montessori schools. There's private schools that are doing this. And when you look at the amount of money that they receive per year, when you think, oh, I don't want to send my kid to a private school, that's really expensive. I'll wind up having to pay something like $7,000 out of my pocket, all the way up to, in some cases, really nice schools, $20,000. But that $7,000 number is one you should be thinking about. If you think that's expensive, then you need to look at the books for the school district, because that's what we're spending per kid. But the results are not the same, because the charter school or the private school doesn't have all that red tape they have to go through. Administration in the K-12 area, particularly in the high schools, is triple what it was 15 years ago. Three times the size across the country. It may not be quite that big here in Texas, but across the country we've got three times as many administrators and we have fewer teachers. Why? Well, because how do we incentivize a school? We incentivize to say you've got to file grants to get money from the federal government. Well, that requires administration. That's not a teacher. They don't have time to stop and fill out the paperwork. They've got to do something that isn't education to get that money. Now, there are requirements that are attached to that grant. You've got to do these specific things. And those specific things also need administration to follow up on them to make sure that they get the grant again next year. If we incentivize people to, you'll get more money if you do things that are different from what you're supposed to be doing as a school, then people will do it. It's pretty amazing. The end result is nobody wants to fire anyone. Nobody wants to downsize. Those are dirty words. Any business owner, that's the nightmare. When it comes to the school system, it's even a worse nightmare, because we're dealing with the cream of the crop, the people that are willing to sacrifice to do something that the rest of us consider a form of insanity, to teach our kids, to sit in the group full of that many kids. That, I mean, just think about that for a minute. That job is hard. And we're incentivizing the school to do things other than that. And to think we've got to cut a budget somewhere. Well, you can't cut administration anymore, because that's where a lot of the money comes from. So we have to cut teachers, and a lot of times the teaching that we cut are the things that we say, well, this isn't used. We don't need music. This isn't used. We don't need the talented and gifted. They're going to make it all right anyway. This causes horrible effects later on, because the incentives need to match the goal. Right now they don't. The incentives match doing more paperwork with the government. And that's something we're seeing not just in K-12, it's across all businesses, in that the regulatory environment is getting to a point where it's very difficult to start businesses. We're still better than the rest of the world, don't get me wrong there, but we're doing worse when compared to ourselves. We've got 8% of the firms that are out there right now in business are startups. 8%. That's a low point since we've been measuring it in the 1950s. It's still a lot higher than anywhere in Europe. Europe doesn't even come close. They're like 1%. And that's high for them. We're at 8%, but we should be at 15 or 18%. Because small business is the lifeblood of our economy, and that's what startups are. Entrepreneurships, that's our bread and butter. That's everything that we are. And if we're taking that away through lack of education or over-regulation, then we're shooting our kids in the foot. And I'm about out of time for this hour. I'll be back next hour. I also have some questions on the Affordable Care Act that I've been talking about. There's good parts and there's bad parts of that thing. And people said, well, what's the good parts and what's the bad parts? Tell me about those. How can we fix it? Rather than repeal and replace or there's nothing wrong with it at all. Those are the two opposing opinions right now. You know, there's nothing good about it, or oh, there's nothing wrong with it. Well, the reality is it is a piece of law, and just like all laws, it's full of sausage. So let's see if we can make it better. There are some better spices here. If you'd like to contact me off the air, I've got voicemail during the week at the Personal Wealth Coach. It's real live people during the week. It's voicemail during the weekend. 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can email me, jake@tpwc.com, or you can go to my webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Until next hour.
News station in Central Texas, News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.